Okay, great. Hi, I'm James. How are you?
Hanging in
We
there.
are live now. We're gonna wait a few seconds to check that everything is okay. Yeah, we are okay here. And we are also live here in LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, and just on time with the Bitcoin ETF approval by the SEC.
Maybe.
Finally. Yeah, maybe. Let's hope this time is for real. So, how's everything? Thank you for joining us. Welcome everybody. This is the second episode of the Blockchain Security Series, and today we'll be interviewing James Unlock, founder and CTO of Casa. James, welcome. What do you think about this ETF approval?
I think it's mostly been interesting to see all of the incompetence over the past few days. These people who are supposed to be knowledgeable enough to protect us and to regulate these markets that are, doing pretty high-tech stuff, they keep proving that they don't know how to operate properly in the high tech space, whether that's from a cybersecurity standpoint, or now it seems just like from a general website management standpoint. Like right now, it's not entirely clear what's going on, but so many things keep popping up and disappearing. It's just ridiculous.
I agree totally. So well, to start, I want to talk so many things with you, but I would like to start asking you, how did you get into security? How did you get into crypto? What was first, and why do you find it so interesting that you are dedicating yourself entirely to this?
Well, I spent the first decade of my career after getting a computer science degree working to build infrastructure for an online marketing company. And over the years, I went further and further into the back end infrastructure. Started out as like a front end web developer and quickly went to the back end where I eventually found myself doing, big data management, trying to be able to ingest petabytes and petabytes of data and help our clients with analytics on their online marketing efforts. And while I was doing that, I was scouring the nerd websites to try just trying to stay on top of technology. Most of what I was focused on back then was more cloud computing. This was the very early days when a lot of people didn't even know what cloud computing was. And one of the websites that I would check regularly was Slashdot, and I started seeing various posts about this cryptocurrency called Bitcoin. And of course, like most people, the first few times I dismissed it, I figured, oh, this thing is not going to last. Everybody's going to lose their money. But third or fourth time that came around, I think it was something about the white paper. Perhaps it was like an anniversary of the white paper or something. And so I finally went and I read the white paper, and I just thought it was an incredibly elegant solution to a problem that I'd never really thought about much. And that was just what kicked off my interest as a hobbyist. I, got some of my first Bitcoin and started playing around with it, started tuning in to the various places for discussion like Bitcoin Talk and Reddit. And about a year later, I actually forked the Bitcoin Core software to create a version I called Satoshi, which was basically Bitcoin Core plus a bunch of built-in analytics and
Satoshi.
statistics. Yeah.
Nice.
And that project went pretty well. It got used and referenced by several developers over the years. And about a year after that, I noticed that a lot of venture capital was coming into the space. And I figured, hey, I'm already spending all of my free time learning and playing around with this thing. So if I could just get paid to do it full time, that seems like a dream job. And applied to a few different companies and was fortunate enough to get a job working at BitGo on their infrastructure, where we were basically, we were helping enterprises and larger custodians secure their hot wallets with multi-signature technology, you know, making it more difficult for those hot wallets to get hacked and drained, because that was one of the biggest problems back then. A lot of people, these centralized custodians, were just losing everything because they were keeping all the funds in hot wallets.
In what year were was this?
So that was February of 2015.
Perfect.
And I was there for 3 years. And that's really where I got into security. I didn't really know much about security other than kind of your standard best practices for secure software development, you know, not trusting user input, you know, preventing malicious input. And it was those 3 years building infrastructure and you know, helping out build the wallet aspects at BitGo that it led me to see a number of mistakes. You know, that's how we learn in security, is people make mistakes. They allow exploits and vulnerabilities, and then we patch them and we learn from them and we move on. And so after 3 years of that, I realized that we had made great progress, at least in the enterprise security space for custodying these crypto assets. But I felt like there was still a big gap when it came to personal security for self-custody. So it was a pretty small pivot for me to take what I had learned and apply that with more of an individual self-custody mindset at Casa, where we're basically we're helping people be their own bank, and we're helping them navigate just a lot of potential pitfalls and foot guns that can happen if you jump into self-custody without really knowing what you're doing.
Yeah, totally agree. Like we always say, self-custody is why blockchain was built, like it was built. But if it's not done right, it's a big risk, right? So how did you start with Casa, and what's the difference between Casa and other services and products available to help this self-custody? And I didn't know, I wasn't so updated, that now you could also use Casa with Ethereum. I thought that it was also only with Bitcoin.
Right. For the first several years, we focused on Bitcoin. You know, that's where the majority of the market value is. And really, what are we trying to do? You know, we're trying to help people not get wrecked. And that means, you know, not get hacked and have funds stolen. But really, I think the bigger problem, anecdotally from what I've seen over the past decade, is that the people who take the step of going into self-custody, if they at least are taking the step of, you know, using a hardware device to keep those keys off the internet, then once you get to that point, the biggest potential form of loss and what happens most frequently is not that your funds get stolen. It's that you screw up and you basically lock yourself out of your own funds. So Casa is taking all of the best practices I've learned over the years, combining them with the best hardware and software that's available on the market, and rolling that all into a really slick mobile app experience, where, you know, your user interface is a nice mobile app, but the keys themselves are secured by a diversity of different hardware in different locations. And the whole point of all of this is to ensure that you don't have single points of failure in your self-custody setup. So we're building for humans. We're building redundancy and robustness into the architecture so that really anyone who is able to follow the instructions in the mobile app immediately gets themselves put into a highly robust setup that is, it's flexible enough to allow you to be a human and make mistakes and have a key get lost or stolen or destroyed. And then that mistake doesn't turn into a catastrophic loss. You can recover from it. This is the fundamental premise of what we're doing. And you know, we leverage a number of different types of software and human consulting services to get there.
So, for example, there's one kind of way that you can configure your CAS account, or there are different ways to configure it. It depends on the user. Depending on the level of the user, is what kind of configuration you recommend. How's the, like a normal onboarding process? How does it work? What hardware devices do they use? I would like to understand that process. And what's it like, the most common, let's say, point of failure that you're used to seeing?
Sure. So we have a number of different tiers, and these are both, you know, different service levels and different key architectures with, you know, different levels of robustness. Our sort of entry level, bring your own hardware and generally more self-guided tier that it's basically $20 a month, like $250 a year. That gets you into a 2 of 3 multi-signature setup. And you're currently able to use that same key set. And this is one of the really unique things. You're able to use that same key set both for Bitcoin and Ethereum and the stable coins that we've added support for. And you know, who knows where this will go in the future. Like I said, what we're trying to do is help people secure the things that are most valuable. You know, people who have the most to lose are the ones that we're trying to service. So the default setup in a 2 of 3 with Casa is that you'll have one mobile key that's actually generated on your phone. It's secured by that secure element. And this is, of course, a hot key, right? It's on an internet connected device. So it is, in a sense, weaker than other keys that are in cold storage. But one of the nice trade-offs and sort of diversity aspects that you get from this is that that key gets automatically encrypted and backed up to your cloud storage. And it's an encrypted in a kind of 2 of 2 fashion, so that, you know, even your own cloud storage provider is unable to read that key. Casa is unable to read that key. But when you get the different pieces of key material and reconstitute them on your phone, effectively you're able to lose your phone or have it destroyed or whatever, and you just go get a new phone and log into your Casa app and your cloud account, and it'll automatically reconstitute that key. So then your second key is going to be on a hardware device. Generally, we recommend Trezor or Ledger, you know, big name brands that have, you know, very secure histories and reputations behind them. But of course, you know, you only have one key on that. So even if there was some issue with Trezor or Ledger, once again, you're not going to have a catastrophic loss. And then finally, the third key is held by Casa, you know, completely offline cold storage. It's not something that's easily accessible, but it's really there as an emergency recovery mechanism. So depending on the tier you're at, the service level you're at, there are different types of authentication mechanisms that can be used to protect the access to that key. And at the lower tiers, it's generally a series of questions and answers that you set up. And if you request a recovery signature from Casa, you have to go through that authentication. And then there's some sort of waiting process, you know, time delay. 7 days is the standard for that tier. And once again, you know, just making it more difficult for, even if an attacker got into your account, even if they knew those questions, you know, giving people time to be able to revoke or repudiate any requests for that key. And so it goes up from there. We also have 3 of 5 tier plans. And, you know, essentially when you add more keys, what you're doing is you're adding more cold storage hardware devices. And, you know, once again, diversity is strength. And so we recommend adding devices of different manufacturers so that, you know, you're not creating potential single points of failure. And at the higher tiers, you'll get more personalized consultation, phone calls with your client advisor. You know, you can basically call us up at any time if you have questions, concerns, if you need to talk about any of the decisions at play, because really all of the decisions around key management involve trade-offs generally between convenience and security. And our client advisors are well-versed in being able to help you navigate and understand every decision that you need to make. And then, you know, at the even higher tiers, we have extremely personalized setup of inheritance products, for example.
I wanted to ask you first, what do you think about the famous 5-pound wrench attack? Have you had cases of people being extortioned?
Yes.
With violence? And what do you think about that? How does the product work? Do you think that's something that usually happens, or is not something that you have been seeing so usually?
So it is rare. I actually have a project where I catalog as many of these physical attacks as possible. And I think we're only aware of maybe 150 of them over the past 15 years, which, compared to all the different types of attacks and thefts and loss, it's minuscule. There are patterns around those type of attacks. And the short version is it always comes down to engaging in risky behavior. So in many cases, the attacks occur against people who are extremely public and flashy. They're going around flaunting their wealth. They're putting themselves into risky situations, usually doing things like engaging in high value face-to-face trades, like with a lot of cash and a lot of crypto. Or what we have seen in other few cases is that In some countries, like Colombia, for example, there are actually gangs that go around and they look for expats and tourists and basically target them with dating scams, and then they drug them and they get you to open up your phone and basically, I think it's scopolamine is like one of these compliance drugs that basically it makes you lose all of your inhibitions, and so we have seen some cases of people who had that happen to them. But in the case of the Casa client that had that happen to them, they did not lose the funds that were in their multisig because they were distributed across multiple keys. And really what happened there is that the attackers managed to drain all of their exchange accounts that they could access directly from the phone. But the other assets that were not directly accessible from only the phone were safe.
Yeah, I don't know if you read about a case that was, I think, that 3 or 4 months ago, that Chapeng Sao from Binance published in Montenegro, I think, mm-hmm. that they had taken like 10 entrepreneurs for a trip or something like that, and they all got robbed, and they finally could trace the funds. But something like that
had. Yeah, so the short version of what do you do about the $5 wrench attack is, and I have an article that I wrote a few years ago on our blog about this, that you have to assume that in a physical coercion situation, you have to assume that you are going to comply and that you are going to do whatever you are told to do. And so the only way to ensure that you don't hand over all of your assets is to ensure that you don't have direct immediate access to all of your physical assets. So that is yet another case of why you want to have your funds distributed across multiple keys that are not easily accessible.
And do you have, for example, the possibility with Casa to say, okay, if I want to move more than 20% of my funds, or if I want to move to this new address or to some address that is not in this whitelist, there's a time lock of, 72 hours, for example. That is something that you recommend to protect us from ourselves, right? From ourselves, but under being pressured.
So we haven't built those type of features into our app. I mean, I think that the whitelist, blacklist, time delay stuff makes sense if you're trying to protect a single key. But when we looked into doing that, ultimately the way that you do that is you just make the keys not accessible. And so then you have to decide, because you have to physically move to some other location, preferably a location that has some level of security around it. In some cases, if you have a five key vault, it starts to make sense to put one of those keys in a safety deposit box at a bank or some other institution, because you can do that. And then, they can institute various access control policies, and it's safe to do that with a multi-sig, unlike with a single sig setup, because you no longer have to worry about that company, that bank, whatever, basically turning on you and denying you access or even taking the contents of your safety deposit box without your permission.
Yeah, totally. And one more question. Imagine, for example, we have a 2 of 3 setup with a ledger, the phone, and the you have the R key. But the problem that we always have with hardware wallets is that in the end, you have a seed phrase, right? In a paper. What do you do with that paper? What's your recommendation for seed phrases? In order always, right? I don't want to lose it. I don't want it to be found. If I have 3 copies, or I have 2 copies and I put half here and half there, but I start having so many copies, I don't know where they are, each of them. So what's your recommendation? I mean, we always say that whatever setup we have, we don't have to say which one we have, but I mean, there for sure there are some recommendations or some options that we can recommend, right?
Yeah, so it depends on the architecture of the wallet. Since the vast majority of people are still using single signature wallets, then if you're in that situation, I think it makes sense to go to more extreme lengths when you're backing up the seed phrase. And I do have a very lengthy blog post about my recommendations for backing up seed phrases. And the short version is that I think the optimal thing to do is to buy a couple of seed plates. There's a few different brands, but basically use a metal backup plate of stainless steel and use one that's literally just one solid sheet of metal. My stress test of 70 different backup devices over the years have led me to this conclusion.
70.
And then, 70 something different metal backup devices I've destroyed over the years. And you actually need to get, I would recommend getting 4 of these, because my recommendation is to use the SeedZor protocol that was developed by CoinKite. And what that allows you to do is it allows you to split up your seed phrase into 2 seed phrases. And the cool thing is that each of those pieces is a valid seed phrase in and of itself. So it gives you this interesting level of plausible deniability, in the sense that if a sophisticated attacker comes across one of these plates and they recognize that it looks like a seed phrase, they can load that seed phrase up into any wallet and there's not going to be anything on it. And so they're just going to assume that, you must have created a wallet and never funded it. But
or you reality, could, or you could put something there too. Yeah. You could also,
you could,
put like
yes.
Something.
Like, yeah. Okay. If you wanted to create a mechanism where you could get alerted, if any of your backup pieces have been compromised. Yeah.
The canary.
Yeah. And so essentially you create this 2 of 2 backup, and then you can, you split those backups, store them wherever you want. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't have to be super high security, because as we've said, a physical attacker won't even know that they only have a piece of a seed phrase. And the main important thing here, and the reason why I said you need to have four different plates, is because this does create a two of two backup, which is brittle. Because think of it like, if you lose one of those two pieces, you effectively lose the whole backup. So you basically need to have two backups of two pieces each.
So what's could you repeat the name of the protocol, or do you have the link so I can share it here from your article where you talk about it? Because
it's called Seed Zor. I love your article.
In fact, last week
SEEDXOR.com.
I know.
And it's very easy to do this if you have a cold card device. I think it's also possible to do it on a piece of paper. I have not tried that myself, to basically calculate the seeds or by hand if you don't have a cold card.
Very good. Very good.
But it's complicated, right? So, I mean, I think it's much easier if you get yourself into a distributed key setup. You don't have to go to those extreme links with the backups. You can literally just back up each seed phrase, in clear text in one piece, because you also know that if that seed phrase gets found by an attacker, you're not going to lose your funds.
Yeah, I agree. And so you started with Bitcoin. When did you decide to start using all this technology for Ethereum? And what changed there?
Yeah, it was really, I would say, a year ago. We had been monitoring it for a while. And of course, our sales and marketing people monitor the feedback that we get, especially whenever we lose a deal because we don't support something. We keep track of all of these things. And we just noticed that demand for Ethereum and Ethereum-based assets, especially stable coins, continued to go up and up over the past few years. And one of our main issues with this is that Ethereum does not support multi-sig as a native function in the protocol. So there's this additional level of complexity and therefore risk factor of how are you going to implement multi-sig. And so we were paying attention to the sort of state of multi-sig and Ethereum, and especially to what was happening with Gnosis and their Safe product, which I think they launched that around 2017 or 2018. And it got to the point where we saw that there were so many tens of billions of dollars worth of crypto assets being secured by Gnosis safes that we felt like, that was a sufficiently high bug bounty that, it's unlikely there's going to be a catastrophic flaw found in them at this point. So what we did when we added support for that is that we're building on top of Gnosis Safe smart contract. We don't want to roll our own crypto. We don't want to write our own smart contracts. I went through that process at BitGo when we implemented Ethereum. And that was like an 18-month process with three or four different audits, and every audit would keep finding problems. It was just a straight up nightmare. And it was so much easier for us to implement this product that is already under fairly widespread use.
And I got a nice question about that. What do you think is most secure, to have assets under, we're talking about Ethereum, right? Assets under one private key, or having a multisig with two of three, for example, but with the possible risk of having I think if Gnosis Safe has a bug in their smart contract or something, and suddenly that breaks, like the whole DeFi and Ethereum and everything explodes.
Right.
But that could happen, right? We see things happening every day. So what do you think about that? Do you think that's like a real risk? Or is it just like so a big risk that we don't care too much about it?
Well, you know, like I said, the name of the game is trying to identify single points of failure. So you know, when you're working with one private key, that's always going to be a potential single point of failure. And of course, there's a million variations of how you might be storing, accessing, using, backing up, recovering from. So it's very hard to just compare it like an apples to apples thing. But you know, if you're doing multi-sig and you're doing it with a smart contract that is not a native part of the protocol, then you know that smart contract itself is a potential single point of failure. So once again, you know, you have to do your due diligence. You have to try the as best as you can to quantify the level of risk. And basically, like I said, you know, we got comfortable by seeing that the changes to Gnosis Safe were slowing down. You know, they didn't feel like they needed to keep tweaking things to improve the security, and the level of funds that were secured by it kept going up. So, you know, it's all relative. It is, in either case, it is possible to create weak setups. So, you know, this is another reason why I think that if you're not a highly technical person, if you're not a security conscious person, it makes sense to pay for some sort of consultation, you know, basically pay for some sort of service that will help you navigate this labyrinth of decision making.
Totally. And regarding Ethereum, because I mean, with Bitcoin, basically you have to keep your Bitcoin safely. But when we talk about Ethereum and we start talking about interacting with protocols, DeFi approvals, allowances, and all that, we start with lots of whole risks. What do you think about what's happening there today? I mean, I see that the last year, with the research that we have been doing, we have seen that one of the attacks that is growing the most is stealing private keys, right? And we see many methods, most of them regarding social engineering or zero-day exploits. So I want to know, what do you think about that? And also, how do you think, or what do you think that the industry should do regarding risks related to DeFi, smart contracts, allowances, phishing, and all that? Because you can have the best setup, but if you sign what you don't have to sign, you're done.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, blind signing in particular has, I think, caught a lot of people off guard. And if I recall correctly, Ledger basically recently announced that they are getting rid of blind signing, or at the very least, I think they're switching the defaults on it because it's become such a huge problem. You know, this is kind of, like I said, it's a potential single point of failure risk, because you can basically click one button and accidentally authorize a malicious contract to drain all of the funds out of your wallet. So, you know, I think that there's some similar best practices that people should use both with Bitcoin and Ethereum and, you know, any other more expressive smart contract platforms. And that is, you need to treat it like you have different accounts, kind of like people do with bank accounts. And by that, I mean, you need to have your long-term savings account, and that's something that you should very rarely be touching. You know, every time you touch your keys, that is a potential risk where you might do something incorrect that you end up regretting. So I'm not like an active trader myself, but I often hear in some of the trader chat rooms, you know, you should keep 90% of your assets in, you know, super cold storage that you don't touch. You're only really actively trading with like single digit percentage of your assets, because, you know, whenever you're trading, you could screw up. I've I've lost a decent amount of money over the years simply because of like slippage and, you know, not understanding what was going on with the orders that I was trying to execute. So there's so many things that can go wrong whenever you're actively using crypto assets. And so, you know, that applies for Bitcoin. You know, I think it makes sense to have single signature wallets that are more of your day-to-day use cases if you're sending money around, and do the same thing with your Ethereum or Solana or whatever wallets, because you know that you are exposing those actively managed funds to just a whole wide array of potential malicious actors. So this is because we have to assume that the average person is just simply not going to be skilled enough to be digging into the details of the smart contracts that they're interacting with and making sure that, you know, this is actually the real smart contract and not a fake smart contract that someone slapped the same name on as a different smart contract. The short version is, you know, whenever you're actively using these assets, you should only be doing that with a very small portion of your stack.
And for example, Casa, you as a company, do you have, you know, what are the addresses, I mean, the wallets of your clients? So for example, you could have the possibility, no, it's something that I'm thinking now, of saying, okay, we are going to monitor the addresses of our clients. And if we see that you have, for example, approved some malicious smart contract, we can do something about that, right? Because I think that nowadays we are seeing more and more tools that are monitoring blockchain and in fact monitoring the mempool. So we are seeing that we can detect attacks before they happen, right? We have seen, for example, the Euler attack was detected by Forta like 6 minutes before it happened. But those 6 minutes were not enough because there was no automation, nothing that posted the contract or anything like that. So what do you think about this active monitoring and things that we can do in real time to stop this kind of threats, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. So to give an example, back when I was at BitGo, we noticed that clients were losing funds due to clipboard malware. So, you know, even despite the fact that, you know, they had these multi-signature setups, they would be copying, pasting address and just not checking it closely and approving it, and off the money would go to some malicious actor. And so what did we do? We went and we scoured the internet for all of the known clipboard malware, and we grabbed all of the addresses that were in that malware, because you know, it would just be, you know, millions and millions of addresses that looked similar, like they would have the same prefixes and stuff. And we dumped all of those into our database and we added a check. You know, whenever you proposed to make a transaction, if it was in our list of clipboard malware databases, we would stop it and we would say, hey, we think something has gone terribly wrong and you should really, you know, check your device and make sure that you haven't been compromised. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that type of warning, because this is what I think a lot of the problems here when we're talking about, you know, phishing type attacks, is that people are getting tricked into rushing through the process and just not checking carefully exactly what they're approving and what they're sending their money to. And I don't think we should not assume that people are going to change their behavior, right? You know, people tend to do the fastest, simplest, most convenient thing, and they tend to rush through stuff. And so, you know, having, you know, checks and balances in the software to basically do that for you is certainly a good thing. Now, one thing that I'll note, like with regard to Casa and how we've set up our Ethereum stuff, is like, we don't even offer the ability for you to approve yourself giving approval to like other smart contracts, at least through our interface. We don't even support it. You know, maybe we will in the future. And if we do, I think we would start looking into, you know, much more of this active management role. But the reason for that is that at least the way that we have built our service so far is that we're really targeting high net worth individuals and enterprises, you know, small funds and stuff, you know, family offices, what have you. And so what you're talking about to date, at least so far, is not really the use case of what we're trying to help provide people for. And so in many cases, and this is true in our Bitcoin product as well, there are a lot of features of the Bitcoin protocol that we simply do not support. And the reason we don't do that is because we actually think it's more dangerous for us to give these more advanced features to people.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, related to, I had a question. I forgot what I was going to ask you. We just talked about the... don't worry. I'll get the question again back. You're basically focusing in storing value for the long term and not in doing DeFi and related stuff. I remember about the copy paste malware. When you did that research in that moment, the malware had the ability of creating addresses that were similar to the one that had just been copied, because I've seen one some weeks ago that when you copy the address, it generates one that ends in the same way. So, I mean, the recommendation of check the last 4 or 6 digits of the address.
Oh, yeah, you need to check the whole address.
You have to check the whole thing, right?
Yeah, and to be clear, the malware is not generating the address on the fly. They are pre-generating millions and millions of like every possible prefix and suffix, and that whole list is loaded into the malware, because otherwise, you know, otherwise it would be too much of a delay. Like it would take your machine way too long to grind through all of the possible addresses, since the, you know, generating an address is completely random.
So if you reverse engineer one of these malware, you can get that whole list. Okay, now I understand how it works.
Yep.
Okay, good. And okay, great. And then I have one more question for you. Do you remember for example, the running hack when they stole like $630 million from the bridge? There was the social engineering attack of one of the technicians that had 4 keys, right?
Right.
So when there's a case like a known entity or project or DeFi project or DAO, whatever, and you have a multisig, right? What do you think about giving transparency to say, okay, these are our signers, right? And they are these people. Or you have, for example, you say, okay, these are our signers, but they are anons. You don't know who they are. Or you just say, okay, we have a setup of 3 signers out of 5, but we won't tell you who they are, if they are different people or whatever, right? So what's the equilibrium that we need in order to know that the setup is secure, but you don't want the project perhaps to give so much information out, right? So an attacker can have that information.
Well, this may not be what you want to hear, but I don't think you can ever really know. It comes down to reputation, right? You can have people attest to being signers, and then, you know, based upon their reputation, you know, if they're all anonymous, especially if they're newly anonymous, they may have no reputation, and that's, you know, really risky because it could all be the same person, right? For example, I am a key holder for the Rootstock sidechain emergency recovery multisig. I'll probably never have to do anything with that key, but, you know, I'm a publicly known person, and I think, yeah, pretty much all of the other key holders are also publicly known people. So in that case, you know, our reputations, I think, are fairly strong. And you know, it's unlikely that we're all lying about being key holders, or that, you know, we've distributed key material differently than how we've claimed to do it. But, you know, ultimately, you can never actually know where is that key material, who has access to it. It's the same problem with any third-party custody provider. They can tell you anything they want to about what their architecture is like that is securing those keys, but you can never actually validate those claims. So there's always going to be a level of trust, even if it's for like a multi-sig federation or a DAO or something.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. I didn't know that you were part of the Roostock multi-sig. Okay, great. And now to close, I would like to talk a bit about two things. First, what happened yesterday with the SEC Twitter account, and the thing about knowing, like, giving, like, how do we know that what we are reading online is true? Basically, we are seeing, like, I'm seeing like 4 or 5 Twitter accounts getting compromised every day. So it's very complicated. So I would like to start with that. What do you think about that? Do you think that we should start like having new mechanisms or saying things like, okay, important accounts should sign their messages, or we shouldn't trust platforms like Twitter anymore? I mean, Twitter has a great issue. That's why Hayden Adams and Vitalik and some other big accounts were compromised. That is, even if you have 2FA, I don't know if they changed this, but if you have 2FA with an application like Authy, Microsoft Authenticator, whatever, or you even have a YubiKey, but then when you wanted to validate your account, you put your phone number. That phone number overrides everything. So if you want to recover right. your account, you just do a SIM swap for that phone number and the 2FA is overrided. So what do you think about all that? About communication platforms? Should we forget about Twitter for this kind of announcements?
You know, I think Twitter is a great platform for, you know, staying on top of what's happening in the world. Now, as you've pointed out, it's not a great platform for verifying the truth or the even the authenticity of accounts themselves. Because what is it? It's a centralized database. I think I saw a great point someone made recently is that it was Matt Odell. He said that, you know, if Elon Musk wanted to, he could put out a post from President Biden's Twitter account and no one would know, because there is no way to validate that, you know, the data is coming from the supposed account holder. So, you know, that is a huge weakness, and that gets exploited in many different ways. I mean, I think one of the ways that we saw a lot of big accounts were getting exploited a few years ago is that there were weaknesses, and perhaps even insiders who were giving access to some of the administrative tools at Twitter itself. And so malicious actors were getting into Twitter's admin tools and able to take over accounts and publish really whatever they wanted and manipulate markets and scam people and so on and so forth. And really, I think what we're talking about now with the SEC stuff, this is a whole other layer of weakness, really, with our telecom providers. And it seems to me like it's mostly a weakness in United States telecom providers. A lot of other countries seem to have better regulations or security around their telecom providers, and it's not as easy to do SIM swaps, for phone numbers and other. So it's all over the place.
Very, very common. In Argentina, to have someone, an insider in a company, to do a SIM swap is just $19. $19, and you get a SIM swap for any person. In fact, like 1 year ago, the security minister of the Buenos Aires government got him swapped, and it was a disaster because he didn't have to FA in Telegram, in WhatsApp, in anything, and they found really complicated stuff. And that things keep on happening every day here. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's actually kind of ridiculous. So, you know, that's the same problem that we just talked about Twitter having, you know, potential insider attacks. This is what's happening at the telecom providers. Now, SIM swaps can happen in a variety of different ways. In some cases, people are actually creating fake IDs and going into a retail store and basically tricking an employee into doing a SIM swap. But as you pointed out, there's also plenty of cases where employees are just straight up being bribed. And I've actually been a part of, I was an expert witness in a case against a major telecom provider that was allowing SIM swaps to happen against this one client like a dozen times, despite the client going in and telling them to, you know, put extra levels of security on there. And eventually what came out was the telecom provider actually like found out and knew that their own employees were being bribed. And I think they fired the employees, but it seems like they haven't actually changed anything about their own internal security policies to add some checks and balances against that. And so the problem you run into with some of these huge telecom providers, especially the ones that have stores on every corner, is that they have given basically administrative access to potentially tens of thousands of employees. So this is a huge security hole, a huge attack surface. And what really amazes me is that you know, the governments of the countries that these telecom providers are having all these problems in, it amazes me that like the government regulators haven't come in and you know, crushed and you know, put the hammer down and said, you need to fix this. This is the one thing that really baffles me. And in short, the only way that I know to get around it is that I no longer have a phone number that is connected to my real name, so that, you know, even a bribed employee at a telecom provider can't look up my phone number and find me because my name is not on any SIM account. And then beyond that, I have extra levels of protection where I actually don't even know my my phone number on my SIM card. I have a dozen proxy phone numbers that I compartmentalize and give out those proxy phone numbers for different things. And those basically forward, you know, the text messages and the phone calls to my real phone number. But this way, even I can't, you know, screw myself and leak my information because I'm only giving out proxy phone numbers that are much easier for me to block and to change. But yeah, it's a huge problem. And it seems like it's only getting worse. And the question is, you know, when are any of the authorities that are supposed to be protecting us actually going to step in and do something about it?
Well, perhaps they're going to step in when this affects them, right? And the episode yesterday, I think it's a good example. Or perhaps when telecom companies start getting being accountable and have to pay for the losses that people have, right? I didn't know this about the proxy phone numbers and the ability to forward like SMS. I think that it's something interesting. Yeah. I think that both, I think that platforms should like stop giving the option of doing like SMS for 2FA or for accounts. That would be like the first thing. But the thing is that everybody has a phone, so it's very easy for them.
Yeah, it's right? Too convenient. And actually, when I was at BitGo in 2016, I believe, we turned off the ability to do SMS 2FA. We wrote a whole big like blog post announcement about it. And because we basically said, look, we can see the trend and we cannot rely upon the telecom providers to improve their security. So we have to just stop supporting it altogether. And so even, you know, even beyond Twitter, like it's amazing to me that, you know, places like Coinbase or Binance or these other major exchanges that have billions of dollars behind them, it amazes me that they still support these quote unquote security features because you know, while the custody practices have gotten a lot better for these, you know, institutional exchanges, we're not seeing the exchanges get their hot wallets hacked and drained nearly as often as we used to, you know, 5-10 years ago. But what we are seeing, there's plenty of people who are keeping all their money on the exchanges, and their exchange accounts are getting drained, and it's usually through SIM swaps.
Yeah, I agree. What I usually recommend is, like, if you have to use your phone number in any of these services, to have, as you say, like a private number that nobody has, and to have it like virtually, right? Like you buy it in Skype, Hashed, or some of these online services.
Yeah, it's not SIM swappable because there's no SIM.
Exactly. Or they have to hack into these systems. But when you don't know when you start by not knowing the phone number, I mean, when the attacker doesn't have any information about you, it's much more difficult. That's why I always recommend, for example, you have a Coinbase account, don't use your normal email for that account. You create another email, have that private email, and use it for that. The same for the phone number. And I do that, but listen to what happened to me. Like 1 month ago, I was in a conference in Europe, and suddenly I get an email from the Apple store saying that I had bought an Apple Watch and had to pick it up in Miami. And they said, what's this? So the first thing that I thought is, this is a phishing email, right? So I checked it, and it wasn't a phishing email. It was a real email from Apple. It had a real order number. So I checked the order number. But what was very strange for me is that I received the email and said, okay, Pablo, my email. And then it said a phone number and the last two digits of the phone number that nobody has. I only have that number and Apple has it, right? And I said, oh, what the fuck is happening here? So to make the story short, there seems to be a bug. I was not able to reproduce this yet. That if you go to the Apple store and you buy something not being logged in, but using the same email that someone has with an Apple ID, in some part of the process, if you finish the buying it, it shows you the phone number that Apple ID has in Apple. So they did all that process just to get my phone number. I said, oh, there's a lot of work here. Like, this is really targeted. And after that, they tried to, they couldn't SIM swap that phone number because it was from a virtual service. But I said, okay, I have to be extra careful, and I had to check all my security settings again. That is something that I really recommend everyone to do once in a while. So my last question for you, because we are nearly on time, is, do you usually do like a whole security checkups for all your security stack? Like, how often do you do it? And if you could leave like two or three easy recommendations for any crypto user to follow, which would you choose? Like easy things that everyone can do, but like that they make a huge difference, right? For the average user.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm in a pretty hardened state at this point where it's fairly low maintenance. And, you know, it's not unless I receive an alert that usually I'll do anything. So, you know, what happens from time to time and inevitably is that, you know, of course, your passwords are going to get leaked from various websites that you've set up authentication on. And so, you know, whenever that happens, you need to go in and rotate those passwords. But if you're already in a good position, then that should not be catastrophic. And, you know, how do you get into a good position? Well, the easy thing is realize that if you know your passwords in your head, you're doing it wrong. You should only really know one password, and that should be the password that gets you into your password manager. And then, of course, your password manager should also be secured by a hardware device, you know, like a YubiKey, for example, some sort of other second factor authentication that requires, you know, physically having access to something. And so if you get yourself into that state and you're using a password manager to generate completely random, insanely long, complex passwords that you don't even know, you're going to get into a really good position there, because even if one of those passwords gets leaked, then you're not going to end up with your other accounts being compromised. And so that's one of the most common things that we see. You know, some service gets compromised, their usernames and passwords get leaked, and then we, or really anyone who runs internet-based services, what you see happen from time to time is you will get a sudden spike in traffic to your service. And what the reason for that is that people will take all of these leaked lists and they will just try every username and password combination against every popular service that might have something valuable hidden in there, because they know that a decent number of people are going to be reusing those usernames and passwords. So, you know, I think that's the easiest thing. You basically have to realize that anytime you interact with a third party and give them any sort of information, you should assume that that's going to get leaked at some point. And so the same thing is true whenever you're giving out your credit card to a merchant. This is why I really prefer using like prepaid debit cards or privacy cards, where once again, you have a different number that you give to each merchant, because I assume that that merchant, over a long enough period of time, is going to get compromised and those details are going to get leaked. And then, you know, someone's going to try and take that number and use it to buy some high value item.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Well, James, it's been a pleasure having you here. Thank you for your time, all your recommendations. I will then make a summary of all the tools and tips you have given us. So, well, many thanks for your time, and we'll see you around in X. So anything else you'd like to add?
Well, mainly that, you know, security, it can be very overwhelming, right? But you don't have to become an expert and go really deep into this. Really, you know, spending a few hours, you know, spending a free day on your weekend to start digging into the basics will already put you into a better position than 95% of the people out there. And really, this is also one of the main games of security, is that you're never going to have perfect security. And this is true for both like digital security and physical security. What you want to do is you want to be a more hardened target than everybody else, because the people, the malicious people out there who are trying to attack people, they're trying to find the best return on their investment of their time and skills. So they're going to be going after the people with really weak security practices. So as long as, you know, you're in that like top 10%, which is not actually hard to get to, then you're going to be pretty good.
Excellent. Well, Jameson, thank you very much for being here, and we'll see you around. Thank you, everybody, for joining us.
Thank you.
Goodbye.